Recording in progress. You are all on temporary mute. Feel free to unmute at will. Okay. Welcome back. We have, by my calculation, this week and next week, before we take a little bit of a break for the various vacation times. So what I wanted to try to pull together the last pieces of the story with Uriah and David, Uriah and Yoav. So today we're going to focus on a quick review of where we left off last week, and then and continue that piece of the story. Where we ended up last week was a conversation about Uriah's response to David when David makes the request, pulls him out of the field, and makes a request that he go back to his house, and sort of an attempt to cover up his own discretion, his own indiscretions. And Uriah's response is not only to remain in Yerushalayim and not go back to his house, but in being when challenged by David, Uriah's response seems to be quite harsh. And he takes an oath and he says he won't do this, and the army of Israel is on the field, and why shouldn't he be together with his troops? There's an intense response in Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vayomu Uriah David, Aaron b'Yisrael v'Yudah Yoshim b'Sukkot, the Aaron and Israel, the army, and Judah, they're all dwelling in booths or dwelling in Sukkot. V'Adoni Yoav, v'Avdei Adoni apnei asadechonim, my master, my commander, Yoav, and all of the servants of my commander, my master, are encamped in the field. And I should go to my house to eat, drink, and to sleep with my wife. As you live on your soul, I will not do this thing. And we had suggested last week that in this response, there is not an insignificant amount of insubordination on Uriah's part with regards to David. So we suggested, and in fact, the Gemara even calls it goes as far as to call it Mored b'malchut, that he is rebelling against the king. And he is an officer in the king's army, and by that, the king is his commander, And by that token, his response here is quite intense. Whether justified or not, not the issue. David will eventually be held accountable for having judged him, but David certainly judges him, sees him as insubordinate, and when he sends him back to the front, he sends him back essentially to be quote-unquote punished for his insubordination. That insubordination is reflected in two pieces of the story. It's a machloket we saw in Rashi and Tosfot. Tosfot suggests that it's because he refused the direct command of the king to go back to his house, maybe because he was aware of what was going on between David and Bathsheba. The alternative, which I think I actually am more biased to, is that the insubordination lies in his overt allegiance to Yoav over and above and against his allegiance to David, meaning his reference here to Yoav as his commander, Adoni Yoav, is really quite, as Rashi says, that the insubordination is in the words of Adoni Yoav, is really quite intense, and that no commander should ever refer to another commander when you're talking to the king as his Adon, as his master. I'll show you that in a moment. And on top of that, he's landed on quite a minefield, because Yoav has a history of being a kind of challenge to David. And so in David's mind, when Uriah reflects on Yoav as his commander, as his master, as his lord, not David, David sees that as a challenge to his authority, as a challenge to the allegiance of Yoav, a challenge to the of the allegiance of Uriah. And so he essentially judges him to as Mored B'malchut. We had spent some time talking about where that rebellion takes place, or where that sense of Mored B'malchut takes place. One of the opinions is Rashi says that it's in the wording, the phraseology, Adoni Yoav, Kra'o Adon, Rashi says, it calls him his master. And that is true. If you look at our Tanakh, anytime you're talking to the king, this is the only time in all of Tanakh where servant A referring to servant B talking to the king refers to the servant B as Adon, as my master. When you talk to the king, everybody is avdecha, your servants. That's just the norm of communication to the king. I showed you this reference, which is in Shmuel Bet, Perek Yedalet, later in the story, where Ishat Kuit is talking to David and referring to Yoav, same Yoav. And she refers to Adonia Melech and Avdecha Yoav. That's normal protocol. You talk to the king, Adon is always the king, and Avdecha, and any other servant, even your own commander, is always Avdecha. You have this throughout Tanakh, Shmuel Bet, Perek Yetet, Vayoma Adonia Melech, Abdi Mimani, Kiyama, Avdecha, etc. Malachim Bet, Avdecha Yishimet, any reference comes to, this is also to David, or this is to Elisha. Any reference to a person of higher authority, anybody else is going to be an Eved rather than an Adon. And so in Rashi's comments, there's a great deal of truth. David, Uriah's response to Adoni Yoav is unique. It's the only place in all of Tanakh where you find a reference to a mid-level commander called an Adon in the presence of the king. And David doesn't like that at all. He thinks, correctly so, it's insubordinate and to be held accountable. And add to that the fact that Yoav himself has a history of challenging David, that it's a minefield that Uriah literally jumps into and lands on, exploding all the mines in his face. Now, having said that, Chazal say very clearly, right, say Medrash, that at the same time that David recognized that Uriah was insubordinate, David is held accountable for his death. The Navi comes to him and he says, you killed Uriah. Well, why should he be accountable for his death if he was insubordinate? And the Gemara's answer is an odd one. The Gemara says, Shayalacha laduno b'Sanhedrin. You should have let the Sanhedrin judge him. You, the king, rather than determining that Uriah was insubordinate and treasonous and Mered B'Machut, should have let the Sanhedrin handle it, which is a somewhat anachronistic description, but essentially what Chazal, I think, are saying is that even if Uriah was insubordinate, and even if Uriah had a slip of the tongue and recognized Yoav in a manner that was inappropriate, and even if he was critical, and he was, critical of David, and in this reference here, he's very critical of David. He's saying, I belong on the field with all the soldiers. David, where are you? And that's essentially the message here. The Ark and Israel and Judah were all sitting in the camp, all engaged in war. And I should go home to have a furlough with my family? Wait, David, where are you? Right? My Adoni Ahav is on the field. Where is Adoni David? And even if that's true, says the Gemara, Hayalo laduno b'Sanhedrin, you should have let the courts deal with it. Meaning, David is not objective. There's not even an impression or a veneer of objectivity in this judgment. David, between his relationship with Bathsheba and between the emotions of the accusation and between everything that's going on, for David to say of Uriah, okay, I'm going to hold you accountable for insubordination, is really an abuse of his power. And David should have let the Sanhedrin or the courts or his advisors or somebody else deal with it. And that would have let put Uriah in a very different position.
What's the punishment for insubordination? Is it death?
Treason in the middle of a war is death. Wow. And that's true, by the way, till today in every military context. Insubordination and treason in the of a soldier in the midst of battle is punishable by death. That is true in the Rambam, that is true in the Halacha, that is true in every military context. Desertion is considered treason, punishable by death. But again, assuming that it's objective and there's an objective court to make that ruling. In this case, David is anything but objective. And therefore, the nature of this decision by David to send Uriah back to the front, but with instructions to have him killed for punished for his insubordination, is certainly a travesty of justice, and certainly considered a moral offense that David should not have committed. But again, David is in a spiral of his own making without recognizing to the extent to which he is deteriorating. And eventually it will take the Navi to kind of jar him out of this spiral to recognize that the mistakes that he has made. So that's where we were last week. That's where we sort of ended up. I added a little bit today just because we kind of rushed at the end of the shiur last week. So I kind of wanted us to see the whole picture. And I'm going to close this source page because I don't think I need it now.
Can I ask you a question?
Forward. Yeah.
Any chance that Uriah just didn't care anymore about his life because he knew what was going on and whatever happened? He just didn't, he gave up? He didn't care anymore?
No, I don't see that at all. First of all, I'm not sure that he knew. That was also part of the debate we had last week. Whether Uriah knew or didn't know is exactly the debate between Rashi and Tosfos. And I'm not convinced that Uriah knows anything of the story at this point, or ever, for that matter. Again, that's exactly the conversation, the debate between the two opinions, Rashi and Tosfos, whether the insubordination is because he refused the command to go home. Ostensibly because he suspected David, or what I think is more likely, with given the context of this pasuk, is that Uriah is a professional soldier. Uriah has been part of David's professional band of soldiers from day one. I remember again also that we've established, or we're working off the assumption that Uriah is Uriah Achiti, meaning that his lineage is probably a Hittite, is probably a paid professional soldier who came into David's service early on, whose loyalty to Israel is there, but his loyalty as a professional soldier is unquestioned. And even when David wants him to go home, he doesn't has furlough in the midst of battle. He would rather stay on the battlefield. And he's ready to go. I says, I want to go back to the battlefield. Everybody else up Nasadachonim is sitting on the front, is ready to go to war. And I'm gonna go home and have and put up my feet and relax. So I think that there's an innocence here. I think that he's correct in his desire to go back to the front. I don't see this as an issue of what he knows or doesn't know about Bathsheba. I think that that's probably a slip of the tongue, but that's just my intuition. That's my sense of this, is that the center of gravity seems to be here on the issue of Adoni Yoav and Apnei Asadechonim and the effort of the army, etc. And at the end of the day, that's also, we have to remember that that's really where the story begins. The story, we're going to come back to this issue after the break. It's an issue I'm jumping a little bit ahead of myself, but one of the major issues we're going to have to address is why David is in Yerushalayim. The army is on the battlefield. David is in Yerushalayim. That's not a problem. That's a big problem. Like the whole story, the whole parak begins with Yoav vayashkitu et bnei Amon veyatsudu al Rabbah. Yoav is besieging the city of Rabbah. David Yosheb Yerushalayim, and David is in Yerushalayim walking on the rooftop of his palace and looking out at the glory of his kingdom. That's a huge problem for us. And I think that's a problem for David, that's exactly what Uriah has hit on. My Adon, my commander, Avdi Adoni Yoav, is on the battlefield. Where are you? In other words, in this statement, there's not an insignificant amount of accusation against David, although he doesn't say it, but he certainly implies it, that if you are loyal to the army, loyal to Israel, you're on the battlefield ready to fighting this war. What, not sitting in the lap of luxury in your home or eating or drinking or whatever else you're doing. Present company, not excluded or not excluded. What is David doing? And abandoning his troops and sitting in Yerushalayim, Yoav is there, you're not. So I think in that regard, Uriah has really hit a serious nerve. And part of why David responds so harshly, because there's not an insignificant amount of truth in what Uriah has said. David has abandoned his troops. He is sitting in Yerushalayim. He has kind of been caught up in this, okay, Yoav, you take care of it. Let me know when it's over and I'll come back kind of attitude. And that accusation hurts, right? So David responds to it as I think is human nature responds to it by being defensive and recognizing that Uriah has crossed the line. Uriah has crossed the line. David should not have held him accountable for it. Given the circumstances, I think David is anything but objective. But it is also true that Uriah crossed the line. That is a fact. And so, in response to it, David does not let up anything here. He doesn't tell Uriah what his intentions are, clearly. He says to Uriah, Shev bazeh gam hayom u'machar, okay, Uriah, you want to stay overnight, another 24 hours, and then I'll send you back to the front. So he does. Uriah stays in Yerushalayim for another day. David
really? Calls,
yeah.
Why does David tell him to stay another day?
I'm gonna address that issue in a second.
All right.
Vayikralo David, vayochal lefanav. The next day, David calls him in for lunch. They eat and they drink and they have a conference, if you will. Maybe he was asking more questions about the front. Maybe he wanted to know more information. Unclear. It just says they had lunch together. That night, again, Uriah stays in with the bunks in with the servants. Not going down to his house. The next day, David wrote a letter to Yoav, and he sent this letter to Yoav through the agency of Uriah. Uriah had come from the front, reported, and now Uriah is going back to the front, armed with instructions from David. In this sefer, David wrote, "Havu et Uriah amul pnei milchama chazaka," set Uriah at the front of the fiercest battle. "V'shavtem me'acharav," retreat from him, don't give him the support that he would otherwise need. "V'ni kavamet," and he will be smitten and die. I'm going to read the rest of the story, and then we're going to come back because I want to talk about this sefer. What's in the sefer? What's not in the sefer? That's my agenda for today. When Yoav was watching the city, he placed Uriah at the place where he knew that the Anshei Chayil, the warriors, were, the front. The men of the city came out and fought with Yoav. And there were many of David's servants from the soldiers of the army who fell that day, including Uriah Hittite. David then sent a report back to, so Yoav sent a report back to David concerning what had transpired. And he tells the agent, he tells the messenger, When you make a report of telling the king all of that has transpired, if the king be angry, and if the king's anger is such that he says to you, why have you attacked the city to fight against it? Don't you know that they can shoot from the top of the wall, that they can drop things from the wall? Attacking a walled city is folly. Who was it who smote Avimelech, son of Yerubeshet? Yerubeshet is Gidon. Avimelech ben Gidon. Hello, Ishai shlicha alav pelach rechev me'alach oma. Wasn't it a woman who threw out a millstone over the top of the wall and it fell on his head? V'yamot betevetz, and he died in Tevetz. And that ended the battle. Lama nikashtem alach oma. Why did you fight? Why did you approach the wall? If all of this is what David says to you and challenges you over the strategy of attacking the wall, va'amarta, you should respond to David and say, gam avdecha Uriah Hiti met, your servant Uriah Hiti also died. Meaning, right, Yoav's response is to attack the city in a way that he knows is controversial. David might challenge him on that. So Yoav's way of diverting the blame for the strategy away from his own decision to attack was to say to David, oh, you know what, David, don't worry. I took care of what you asked me to take care of. Uriah Hiti is no longer. It's all done. And that should appease the king. So writes Yoav, or instructs Yoav, to the messenger to tell David. Vayelech HaMalach, his messenger comes to David. Vayavo v'yaged l'David et kol asher shlacho Yoav. He comes and he tells David what Yoav had sent him to tell him. Vayomer HaMalach al David, and the messenger reported to David saying the following. Ki gavru aleinu anashim, the men prevailed against us. Vayetzu aleinu asadeh, they came out, attacked us in the open field. And we were upon them all the way to the entrance of the gate. But then the sharpshooters from the top of the wall began to shoot at us. And many of your servants died, including Uriah-hiti. David responded to the malach and said, to the messenger and said, oh, this is what I want you to report back to Yoav. Don't be displeased over this thing. That is the casualties of war. The war will devour many. Be strong in your battle against the city. Overthrow it. Encourage. Be strong. Finish the job. All right, the rest of it is back to Asia, to Batsheva. We'll deal with that at a later time. In fact, that's exactly what happens. Yoav does, in fact, attack the city. I'm going to skip the whole nevuah of Natan and conversation between Natan and David for a moment and jump to the end of the next parak, partially because it's related to this and it's a piece of the story that's chronologically out of place. So if we go to the end of the next parak, we find the continuation of the battle. End of parak Yibet. Vayilachem Yoav b'Rabat b'nei Amon. Yoav fought against the city of Rabah of Amon. Vayilkodet Yiram Lucha. And conquers and takes the city, the royal city. He breaches the walls and he takes the city. Vayishlach Yoav malachim al David, Yoav sent messengers to David saying, Vayomin elchamti b'Rabah, I fought against Rabah, gam lachadati et Yiramayim, I have taken the city of the waters. The city of the waters in a walled city is the water source between the two walls. Walled cities are always a double wall. and the water source was typically between the two walls. That's usually what's referred to as Yiramayim. Now, therefore, David, gather the rest of the army and come and help attack the city. Lest I take the city myself, and then it will be called my victory and not yours. David gathered the rest of the army, went to Rabbah, and he fought against it, conquered it. He took the crown of Malkam off of his head. The weight of this crown on the god Milkom, which is the gods of Ammon, was great. It was heavy. It was weighed a talent of gold. It was very precious. David put it on his own head. And took a lot of much of the spoils of the city. And the people, he took them and he put them under the saw, ubacharitzei habarzel, harrows of iron, ubimagzerot habarzel, and axes of iron, vehavirotam b'malben, put them through a brick kiln. V'chein yaseh l'chol arei b'nei Ammon, thus he did to all of the cities of Ammon, yashav David b'chol ha'am Yerushalayim, and then returned to Yerushalayim. All right. There's a lot to talk about. Let's start with 24 hours. Why does he need another 24 hours of the rain?
So this 24 hours, he gets him drunk. He makes sure he gets him drunk.
I don't know. You know, we tend to think of the word Bayishakwe as drunk, but in Tanakh, that's just every meal is Vayochal Vayesh because they ate and they drank. That's how you describe a meal. So I'm not sure that's the emphasis here.
He must have been thinking about what he wanted to say to Yoav.
Yeah, that's my intuition. My intuition is that I think he needs 24 hours because he wants to research. In other words, once he's decided that Uriah is going back to the front and now he's going to send instructions, there's a lot of information that Uriah has put on the table that David needs to understand much more intently before he responds. And there are a lot of questions, the status of the war, the status of the army, the morale of the soldiers, the significance of this protracted war with Ammon that's been going on for who knows, for better part of a year, the moral issues in battle, a lot of questions that you're going to sort of assess the strategy of the campaign up until now and report back to the commander on the field and say, okay, we're going to modify, adapt, change, move forward, etc. There's a lot of information that he needs, much like Esther. When Mordechai says to her, you have to go to the king, her response is to Mordechai is, okay, give me 3 days. What does she need 3 days for? She needs 3 days to fast. Chazal says she wasn't fasting at all. Everybody else was fasting. She was preparing herself. She needed 3 days to figure out what was really going on in the kingdom. She needed 3 days to manage her own board of inquiry to figure out how is it that this decree came about, only to discover that it was all about Haman and the ring, etc. So she needed time. I think that David's request for 24 hours before sending Uriah back is legitimate. Again, coming back to Pasuk Yud Aleph, it's clear that Uriah wants to go back to the front. That's what he says. He says, I belong on the battlefield. All my brethren are al pnei hasadeh chonim. What am I doing here? Essentially asking of the king, I want to go back. What does the king say to him? I'll send you back, but I'll send you back 24 hours from now. Spend the day tomorrow, and then I'll send you back. Okay? It's not to go back to his house. It's not to deal with Bathsheba, but I think it's to deal with this sefer that that he wants to write. And in that sefer is going to be a significant amount of information. He needs to put it all together. Having said that, the oddity of this sefer that he writes back to Yoav is, at least if I take this text at face value, Vayi baboker vayichtav David et sefer el sefer. Sorry, vayichtav David sefer el Yoav vayishlach miyad Uriah. He sends the book, a letter, back to Yoav. Vayichtav basefer havu ad Uriah mupnei melchama. What's in this letter? What does the letter say? The letter says, put Uriah at the front of the battle. I don't know. It just strikes me as you don't need 24 hours to write a letter that says one sentence. I can imagine he had to reword the sentence many times. But at the end of the day, it shouldn't take 24 hours to write one sentence. So what's the
reason? I'm going to stick with my hypothesis because he says to drink with him and eat with him, but in the next say he says drink, eat, and be ashkarehu. That's not in the first mention, right? But why would they say eat and drink language, and drink some more? I guess is what it right.
I hear you, but I don't think it's an issue of getting drunk. Like the language in Tanakh is different. People get drunk in Tanakh, you know, there's a few instances, but it's very, remember, they don't have running water. If they're having a meal, they're drinking wine with the meal. So I don't think that that's really, maybe he just wants to demonstrate the camaraderie and brother, I don't know. But I'm more convinced that this 24 hours is to write this sefer of instructions. Because I'm also convinced that the sefer does not contain one line. It's not possible for David to write a letter back to the commander in chief, or for the commander on the battlefield of all of the siege of Ammon after all of these wars, and for it to include one sentence, especially if that one sentence is a command that is inherently an illegal order. And you can't, for David, from Yoav's perspective, what is David asking Yoav to do? Take one of his soldiers, one of his commanders, and execute him. On the basis of what? Doesn't say. So for Yoav to just kind of blindly follow, that's complicated. I don't think that's what's in the sefer. This is even textual references. This is Vechtov David Sefer. He wrote a Sefer. Vechtov Ba Sefer Lemor. He wrote a Sefer. He wrote a book. He wrote an instruction, a letter. And in that letter is included, it says the following. Meaning, I think David buried this instruction regarding Uriah in a lengthy rewrite of the strategy of this campaign. And the question is, can we recreate what it was that David had instructed Uriah to do? Is there a way to recreate, at least conjecture, the content of this letter? Why it's important will emerge from our discussion. But I think that there are two primary issues that David wanted to address in this letter, which he wanted to change in terms of the way this campaign had been conducted. And you can see it in the difference of the campaign before this letter and after this letter. Meaning, all we need to do is to take a look at everything that has transpired from the perspective of the war with Ammon, Yoav, prior to this letter, and everything that transpires after this letter, and see and assume that therefore, whatever changes have occurred in terms of instructions, have occurred because of David's letter. So let's break it down. What's the first issue? First issue is that David has been accused by Uriah, and I think rightly so, of letting Yoav run this campaign and for David to be conspicuously absent. That was the issue that Uriah raised. Adoni Yoav, Apnei Asadei Chonim, my master Yoav is on the field. Dot, dot, dot. David, where are you? So the first thing we need to recognize is that David decides in this letter that he's taking back command of the army. To allow Yoav to be perceived as the commander and the head and the Adon and the virtue and the almost the king is very dangerous for David. And David needs to re-establish his authority. How does he do that? He's still in Yerushalayim. He'll eventually come to the field, to the front. But how does he do that from Yerushalayim? So let me ask you a simple question. Up until this point in the story, how many times have we seen in this campaign, Ammon, Moab, etc., how many times have we seen in this campaign Yoav send a messenger or a letter or a report back to David?
Zero.
The answer is none. What we do find is David sends to Yoav a request to have Uriah come and report to him. Right? That's back in Pasuk Vav. Vayishlach David al Yoav, shlach elai et Uriah Hiti, send me Uriah Hiti. Why? To report. And that's what Uriah does. Uriah goes back and David inquires, Vayishal David v'shlam Yoav, v'shlam ha'am, v'shlam ha'melchama, and then the rest of it progresses from there. But up until that point, we have no reference to any place which Yoav sends a report back to David. Then David sends this letter to Yoav. Okay, whatever's in this letter. What happens next? Yoav attacks the city, where he sends Uriah and a group of Chayalim to attack the city. We'll talk about that in a moment. And the moment that attack fails, the moment that attack fails, what does Yoav do? Yoav reports back to David exactly what transpired. He attacked the city. This is what happened. People died. Uriah died. Okay. That's number one. Mentioned before, Perek Yudbet, the end of this campaign, is part of the same story. I hard for me to prove that to you right now, but take my word for it. The conversation between Natan and David is post the birth of the child, which is 9 months later. The siege of Ammon ends right away. See, the siege of Rabbah does not wait 9 months. So this end of Perek Yudbet, where we have the description of the actual conquest of the city, that's connected. That's really the postscript to chapter 11, not chapter 12, just to put it in perspective. So again, continuing the same campaign, Vayilachem Yoav b'Rabbah b'nei Ammon, captures the city. And what does he do the moment he captures the city? Vayishlach Yoav malachim al David. He sends a message to David, and he says, Vayomer, Nilchamti b'Rabbah gam lakadati et Yiramai. I conquered the city. I have, in fact, captured the water sources. We've breached the walls. We're ready to move in for the kill. And then he adds, okay, David, now's the time for you to come. Because otherwise, I'm going to have to command this army as it comes into the city by myself, and that would be inappropriate. So at least three times, Yoav sends a report back to David, but only after he received this letter from David. So I think in part I can make the assumption, it's a fair assumption to make, that by sending this letter back, whether explicitly or implicitly, he's sent a shot across the bow to Yoav saying, I'm still commander in chief. And whatever happens, you will report to me. I want to know what's going on. I will direct the campaign from here and I will join you when I'm ready. But essentially, part of this letter, I assume, was to either explicitly or implicitly reflect back to Yoav that David is still in charge. That's one piece of the story.
Excuse me, but surely Yoav would have sent other messages to keep David informed of what's going on there. May not be important for us to know what they said.
I would assume you were correct were it not for the fact that we have no reference to it at all. And from Uriah's own reports, he's describing Yoav as their perceived master commander in charge, Vadoni Yoav. And subsequent to this letter, Yoav reports three times. So, yeah, it's possible that there were other reports on a regular basis. We don't have any reference to them. But by placing the emphasis here, it seems to be a reflection of a much larger role. And whether maybe he reported more often or more regularly, or he took more direct instructions from David, it's possible that beforehand it was just kind of reports of what was going on. Okay, all is well, we're still on the battlefield, but now it's, okay, David, what's my next move kind of report? Unclear. But the tenor of David's role in this campaign certainly changes. On top of that, there is a dramatic change in strategy, and that's really the core of the issue. Because not only is there a change in the nature of David's role in terms of information, but David in this letter, I believe, changes the strategy of the campaign. And it's a window into a fundamental difference, whether initially or at this point, between Yoav and David in their attitude towards this war. I wonder what you would say if I asked you to compare the description of the battle in Pasuk Aleph to David's instructions to Yoav at the end of the parak. The description of the battle in Pasuk Aleph, "Va'ilu tshuvat ha'shana le'et tzet ha'malachim v'yishlach David et Yoav et avada v'imo v'et ko Yisrael." David sent Yoav and his servants with him and all of Israel, "Va'yashkitu et b'nei Amon," to attack, to destroy Amon. "Vayatsuru al Rabbah," and they besieged the city of Rabbah. "V'David yoshev b'Yerushalayim," and David at that point returned to Yerushalayim. Compare that to Pasuk Chafei. "V'yomer David al Hamalach," David says to the messenger, "Ko tamar Yoav, al yirah b'einecha t'davar hazeh," don't worry about this thing, about the casualties, "ki kazov chazet t'chalachar," casualties are part of war. War will, the sword consumes so many people. "Hachazek milchamtecha l'ir v'harsa v'chazkei," make your attack against the city strong, overthrow it, encourage him to do so. What's the difference between Pasuk Aleph and Pasuk Hey?
One is very passive and the other one is very active.
One's passive, one's active. The first is a description of a siege war, and this is a description of a frontal attack. In other words, what's transpired is a dramatic change in strategy. Rabbah is a major city. It's a walled city, double walled city. Water sources inside the city. The classic kind of walled city, Ir Miftzar, that to go up against with an army of foot soldiers without battering rams and without ramps and without whatever other technology was used in the ancient times to deal with the walls was tantamount to suicide, because all the army of the enemy is sitting on the ramparts shooting down arrows and killing any soldiers who come near the wall. The best way to campaign against a walled city is?
Siege.
Starve them out. You've got all the time in the world. You siege the city from the outside. You starve them from the inside. weaken them, siege them. How long does it take? A siege war? Edom took 6 months. This a year already. 2 years, 3 years. The siege of Yerushalayim took a year and a half. The siege of the Shomron in Malachim Bet took 3 years. And there's lengthy descriptions of the famine inside the area of the Shomron before the city fell. A siege war takes time, but it has a huge advantage. What's the advantage of a siege war over a frontal attack?
Casualties.
Casualties. Far less casualties. Far less casualties. You virtually take the city on with after it's fallen because it can't defend itself anymore. When they start this campaign, they reached the city of Rabbah. Yoav makes a strategic decision. Vayatsuru Rabbah. They're going to besiege the city of Rabbah. A siege war can take an extraordinary amount of time. David is going to sit there on the battlefield while the siege is going on, a year, 2 years, 3 years, however long it's going to take. Yoav will sit there on the battlefield because that's what he does. David will go back to Yerushalayim. When the walls are breached, call me. I totally believe that David had every expectation and anticipation that when the walls were breached, he would come back to the battlefield. But just to sit there while everybody else in Yerushalayim needs his leadership is also problematic. So we have a siege at the beginning of the story. After his 24 hours of assessment, David changes the tactics. And his new instructions to Yoav are, finish this campaign as quickly, as effectively as you possibly can. Get out of this war. Siege wars are complicated. One of the great miracles of Sefer Yehoshua is that in all of the campaigns that Yehoshua led to fight to conquer the land of Israel, there was not one fight, not one battle that Yehoshua led that was against a walled city by besieging the walls. There were many walled cities in Israel. The first that they encountered, of course, was Jericho. And Jericho fell miraculously, right? This whole story of the trumpets and the shofars and the surrounding the city seven times. Jericho fell miraculously. After Jericho, if you remember the story of the conquest of Israel, Sefer Yehoshua, after the fall of Jericho, they go to the city of Ai. City of Ai is also a walled city. A little bit of a complicated story we're going to talk about next week. But in the city of Ai, they managed to draw the army out of the walls. And so they fight in the open field. Then they make peace with the city of Givon. And out of retribution against the city of Givon for making peace with them, all the armies of the south, Hebron and Debir, and all of the armies of the south, the walled cities, the big fortified cities, they come out to attack Givon. And Yehoshua, when the city of Givon, when the kings heard that David had conquered Ai and that they had made peace with Givon, so they gathered all their forces, and Adoni Tzedek, Melech Yerushalayim, and Melech Hebron, and Melech Yarmut, and Melech Lachish, and Melech Devir. They gathered all these forces, and they went to attack Givon, these five kings. And so Yehoshua, in the middle of the night, Avayal Yehoshua min ha-Gilgal, hu v'chol ha-amet m'chamayim, v'chol gibarei ha-chayel. So in the middle of the night, Yehoshua takes his army, and he runs, and he literally attacks them suddenly. Vayavolehem Yeshua pitom kol alayla, attacks them in the open field, because all these walled cities, Yeshua is racing a clock. We talked about this when we studied Sefer Yeshua. The two major challenges that Yeshua faces are the walls of the walled cities and the alliances of the kings of Israel, of the kings of Canaan. The more that he can conquer quickly and in the open field, the better. Here he has four kings or five kings that have come together, so. And in open field rather than sitting in their own city. So he attacks them and he is able to overpower them. Because in the open field, Yeshua has a has a fighting chance, if not a better chance, than most of these armies. And as he's attacking, as he's on the offensive, look what he writes. Look what it says. Jumping down to the end of this parak, Yeshua parak Yud, V'atem, he says to the people of Israel, Al ta'amodu, don't stand, don't wait. V'dfu acharei bechem, chase after your enemies. V'zinav temotam, catch up to them. Al titnum lavo el areihem, don't let them go back to their cities. God has given them into your hands. That's not a function of just, okay, wipe them out. That's a function of if they go back to the cities, we lose the advantage. They go back to their walls, they shut themselves into the walls, and now we're stuck with a siege war. We need a blitz war. We need a blitz campaign so we can get in this and out of this. And that's exactly what happens in the context of Yehoshua. Prolonged campaigns, prolonged, protracted wars create all kinds of problems. And that's exactly what David assesses, I believe, assesses in these 24 hours. What is the price we have paid for this protracted siege of Ammon? We've avoided the casualties of war. True. That's the advantage. Okay? Now we're going to weigh that against the disadvantages. What are the costs of war? And the cost of this protracted war, remember, we're dealing with the campaign of Yerushalayim, three campaigns against the Plishtim, the war against Moab, the war against Ammon with the alliance of Aram, the war against Aram in the north, Aram Tzoba and Aram Naharaim, the war against Edom, 6 months war against Edom, and now a protracted year-long siege of Ammon. How long have they been at war? Prolonged, protracted military campaigns that, I'll argue, take it one step further, not so clear that these campaigns were necessary. Can you argue that the campaign of David in the north against the armies of Aram was a Mechemet Mitzvah necessary to defend the people of Israel, or was it an expansion of the boundaries and the borders of the land of Israel into the great empire from the Nile to the Euphrates? You start to question the legitimization, the justification of this war. Protracted year after year army and military campaigns takes its toll. It takes its toll on the morale. And I will go one step further and say something which is somewhat controversial. I think it takes its toll on the morality of Israel. Let me phrase it differently. How many Bathshebas are there in the land in amongst the people of Israel right now? If David found one Bathsheba, how many other Bathshebas are waiting for their husbands on the battlefield and fall into the circumstances of protracted war?
Many.
Right? It's complicated. And if David wasn't able to see the moral offense of his own actions, imagine how many other people were falling into this trap. Even when he finally wins battle after battle, there are descriptions in these campaigns that raise serious moral questions. We saw already last year when we read the story of Moab in Parak Chet, when David conquers Moab, and it's a retribution for Moab's role in aiding and abetting Aram to come into the land of Israel. Vayachat Moab, vayimadedem b'chevel hashkevotam arza vayimaded shnei chavalim lamit umulah chevel achayot. He laid them down on the ground, the two lines he put to death, one line he kept alive, marking them with a rope. Unclear what this is, but whatever it is, it's not nice. It doesn't read well. It raises serious questions. 6 months, they're campaigning in Edom, Lachrit Kol Zachar, to eradicate the entire army. There's serious questions about what the morality of a long, protracted war, e.g. Vietnam, e.g. the war in Lebanon. We know from our own history of what happens to a people, what happens to an army, what happens to a society with a long protracted war whose justification is questionable and certainly questioned after a lengthy period of time. So David looks at this long protracted campaign and his conclusion is Uriah's right. But Uriah's conclusion is go back to the battlefield and wait for the siege to end. David's conclusion is get out of this war as quickly as you can, because this war is going to erode the moral fabric of Israel. Not to mention the fact that protracted wars are politically dangerous. And David knows that. David doesn't know what's going to happen in the future, but he knows what's happened in the past. But I'll show you two examples of what happens in the future of what happens to kings or what can happen to a king when their armies are out on the field and they're sitting in the palace. I'll give you two examples, both from Tanakh. There are many in history, but we don't have to go that far afield. Here's a story from Melachim Aleph Perek Tet Zayin. Melachim Aleph Perek Tet Zayin, kings, northern kings of Israel, starting with Pasuk Chet, Bishnat Esrim V'shei Shana La'asa Melech Yehuda, Malach Ela Ben Ba'ashal Yisrael B'tirza. Whatever year in the year of the kings of Judah, new king of Israel, northern kingdom in Tirza, his name is Ela Ben Ba'ashal, and he reigned for 2 years. They're in the middle of a protracted war, it doesn't say it here, but they're in the middle of a protracted war against actually, I don't remember who the war is against. Let's say earlier. Don't remember. But that's okay. Veikshor alav avdo zimri sar machzit arachet. His servant, this Ela ben Ba'asha, after 2 years, his servant Zimri, who was the captain of his chariots, meaning he was the commander of his army. He was the Yoav of David. He was the Yoav of Ela ben Ba'asha. Vayikshor alav avdo, and he rebelled, conspired against him. And he, this king, this Ela ben Ba'asha, was in Tirza, shoteshikor. There, Ronnie, there I agree with you. This shoteshikor is drinking himself drunk. That's, here I agree. Beit Arza, the house of Arza, Sheral Bayit Betitza, Bayavo Zimri, Bayakeo, Bayimiteu. And Zimri came, stabbed him, killed him, and took over the reins. The army is out on the battlefield. He's sitting in his palace drinking, and comes along the captain of the army and says, enough. Okay, one knife and ends the story. There's another story in Melachim Bet, Perek Tet, story of Yehoram, who came back to his palace, for Yashav Yehoram HaMelech Lihitrapeh B'Yisrael, in the middle of battle. Mina Makima Shiyakua Aramim, they're in the war against Aram, and the army is on the battlefield. Yehoram is wounded, so he comes back to the battlefield, to his palace, to his vineyard, to recuperate, Lilachamo, to heal. And because the war, they're in the middle of war against Hazael Malach Aram, and Yehu shows up and his ballast and kills him, and new regime. Regimes change in the midst of battles. I don't think that's so far afield from David's mindset either. Whatever the consideration is, David has one agenda. In this Sefer, I believe he tells Yoav, enough with the siege, end the siege now. You attack the city, whatever, come what may. We'll deal with the casualties. This campaign ends now. That, I think, at the end of the day, is the primary message of David's letter to Yoav. Come back to the letter itself. Vayichtov David Sefer El Yoav. Vayichtov Basefer. And in the Sefer, he writes, Et Uriah You know who should lead the campaign? He writes to Yoav. I have the perfect candidate for you to lead the campaign against Ammon. He's a loyal soldier. He's a great soldier. He's devoted to the campaign. He wants to see this campaign through. He's a professional soldier. He's not going to abandon the battlefield. Uriah, send Uriah to the front. Let him lead the campaign against Rabbah ben Ammon. We'll deal with the rest of this phrase next week. And that's exactly what happens. The next part of the story is Vayhi b'shmo Yoav et ha'ir. As they're watching over the city, besieging the city, he sends Uriah through to the battlefield. And a direct assault against the city of Rabbah. It doesn't go well. For whatever reason, it fails. We'll talk about all of the battle tactics next week. But from David's perspective, David changes the strategy of how this campaign is going to be fought. From a siege war that would have few casualties, would have a great deal of, that would take a great deal of time. And time right now is David's enemy, because the moral and political ramifications and dangers that David sees in the protracted campaign right now outweigh the potential dangers of a direct frontal assault. And so he says to Yoav, finish the job.
Do we worry or do we think about any of the guilt that David might feel when he's writing this letter or not?
I can only imagine there is some, but at this point, David's so engrossed in it, so in the midst of it, I don't think he sees it yet. That will come when Natan challenges him. When Natan challenges him for not only the story of Bathsheba, but for the death of Uriah and for the failed campaign against Rabbah, because it's a failed campaign, and why it's a failed campaign, and all of that's on David's shoulders, then David will feel the guilt. But that all comes in the next chapter.
But there's surely, surely his predicament with Bathsheba prompted him to call off the siege at that time.
Yes.
And in particular, why must he say that Uriah should be smitten? He shouldn't write that in there to...
Oh, so let's talk about that next week. There's two ways to read that. It's possible that he didn't actually write those words, but that's the implication of what he wrote. In other words, he said, put Uriah at the front. And in his mind, he's thinking, so that Nikavameh, right? Or he did instruct him so, and he instructed him so because of the insubordination and treason and whatever the case is. We'll see. What the implication of these four words, v'shavtem me'acharav v'nikav emet, retract from him, retire, meaning don't give him the support from behind that he needs. The implication there we will see next week when we look at this in more detail. But for now, what I wanted to see is the overall context of this letter, which is much bigger than Uriah. Today's shiur is really in the field of conjecture. I have no evidence to what I'm suggesting to you, but it just fits the context. It fits the context of Yoav's change in attitude, his change in tactics against the war. Literally, from a siege war that has lasted a year, post this letter, they're attacking. They're attacking the city. They're attacking the city more than once. Uriah's attack on the city, which fails, and then they attack again, and this time they conquer. They conquer the wall. They conquer the city of the water sources. They breach the walls, and now David comes back into the field. All of that that's described at the end of chapter 12 is happening here. That's all in response to David's letter. The constant reports back to David, because I think David wants a more direct role in what is transpiring, in part because Yoav has led a campaign, rightfully so, which is a siege war, but it's lasted a year, and it has had a horrible impact on the morale and morality of the people, / David and on them. And David has decided, okay, enough. let's stop this. Let's turn it around. Let's turn it into a frontal attack. I want to make one thing very clear, however. David's decision to go in to end this war now at all costs, end it quickly, should not be read as a decision to surrender or appease or buckle. On the contrary, what he instructs Yoav to do is expressed in this phrase here, "Hachazek milchamtecha la'ir v'harsa v'chazkeu." Make your battle against the city strong, even stronger. Overthrow it. There is no option for a battle that ends in a stalemate. This battle will end in victory, says David to Yoav. It must end in victory. But it ends in our victory, and it ends in a victory quickly. That's the difference. And that's going to come with casualties. That's why he says here, Kazov Chazetach Alacherev. That is going to come with casualties. I recognize that. David will take responsibility, as every commander has to take responsibility for the decisions of the campaign. But that's what he says. The impact it is having against both the morale and the morality of the people of Israel is such that we cannot afford to let this campaign continue, nor can we afford for this campaign to end in a stalemate. And so he pushes Yoav against Yoav's better judgment, but he pushes Yoav to overthrow the city, to destroy Ammon, and to end the siege. And in the midst of all of that, he throws Uriah with the understanding that Uriah is going to be a casualty of war. That piece of the story we'll talk about next week. But I wanted to see the context, because sometimes we forget that David is, besides being a poet and a passionate soul and a passionate individual and having slipped into a moral quagmire, David is also chief and not to forget a strategist and a warrior, and that's part of this whole story, is that David has taken his role as the head of the army and kind of relegated it to Yoav, and it's cost him a great deal. And so this is part of David retaking the reins of this campaign. Okay, I will stop here. And anybody has any final questions? Otherwise, we will. No?
Thank you.
Very good. Okay, so Bezrat Hashem, we will continue. We will meet next week. My anticipation is that after next week, we'll take a 2-week break. And then, right, is that right? I got the dates right. Next week is the 13th, the 20th, and the 27th. All right. Well, at least 2-week break, maybe 3. We'll see. I'll let you know by email, but for sure, next week we're meeting, and then I'll send you a schedule from there.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.